Good afternoon, everybody. The time is 2 o'clock. Welcome to the Vox Pop for Tuesday, May 23rd. I'm Alan Shartok. A suicide bombing at a concert in Manchester, England last night killed more than 20 people. The Islamic State terrorist group has claimed responsibility. The attack comes as President Trump is on his first official overseas trip, including stops in the Middle East, calling for peace in the region. In the studio to discuss the attack and more is Professor Victor Assal of UAlbany's Rockefeller College of Public Affairs and Policy, where he heads the Project on Violence Conflict. Number to call, 1-800-348-2551. 1-800-348-2551. Going to be a lot of calls. Get yours in now. Get online. Your calls and more are all coming up on the Vox Pop right after this news. Hello again. Welcome back to the Vox Pop, WAMC's live daily afternoon call-in talk show. I'm Alan Shartok. A suicide bombing at a concert in Manchester, England last night killed more than 20 people. The Islamic State terrorist group has claimed the responsibility. The attack comes as President Trump is on his first official overseas trip, including stops in the Middle East, calling for peace in the region. In the studio to discuss the attack and more is Professor Victor Assal of UAlbany's Rockefeller College of Public Affairs and Policy, where he heads the Project on Violence Conflict. Victor Assal also chairs the school's Public Administration Department. Sir, welcome to the Vox Pop.
Thank you.
And welcome back. I'm delighted to see you here. The number to call is 1-800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551, or you can email us at voxpop@wamc.org. But we'd rather hear from you on the phone today, and many of you will call because this is going to be a very fast program and a lot of people are going to want to get in on it. So, Professor, what is it that we have to do to mitigate this kind of thing happening?
So that's a multifold question that we need to think about. On the one hand, identifying people who are people of interest, deciding which of those people of interest we should be paying attention to, and by we, I mean security forces. That's on one side of the equation. On the other side of the equation is thinking about how we can make soft targets more secure, with the understanding that you can never make them totally secure.
Now, what do you mean soft targets?
So if I'm a terrorist or I'm somebody who's going to be embracing political violence, it's one thing to attack a military base. It's something else to attack a school. And soft targets are targets that don't have the same kind of security apparatus as hard targets do.
Although it has to be said that they've had plenty of success attacking so-called hard targets also.
That is correct. And that's one of the real challenges that terrorism and political violence present to states and leaders, which is there's no 100% solution. There's not even a 97% solution.
Okay. If you were president now, what would you do?
If I was president right now, what would I do? If I was president right now, what I would do is I would take a look at several aspects. One, what are the soft targets that we should be investing in having more security around them?
Remember, every one of those people who went into that stadium yesterday was checked. They put the bomb outside in the ticketing area.
Which gets back to this issue of it gets back directly to the issue of no target can be 100% secure. Right?
Right is right. I argue with my wife. I don't want to go to Times Square.
Well, I still go to Times Square. And that's one of the other issues that as president, I think the president needs to make it clear that America faces a threat of terrorism, but there are lots of threats that are much more serious. We should not become obsessed with terrorism. Alan, you can tell your wife that you're much more likely to die in a car accident than you are
to tell her that. She needs
to tell you that. Okay.
And does.
Put her on the phone with me and I'll explain. There's a lot larger threats to your life than terrorism. The other thing that I think the president needs to do is to make it very clear that Americans need to make a distinction between ethnic groups, religious groups, and organizations and ideologies. And we can't just pick an individual and stereotype across a large segment of the population, because if we do that, we're demonizing them. And demonizing them is exactly what the terrorists want.
Why do they want that?
They want that because the more that they can make us demonize a group of people, the more they can make people in that group feel bad and feel discriminated and feel oppressed, and the more they can recruit other people to be part of their organization.
Is there any indication that if that is their philosophy, that their work it's working?
I think, for example, that it has done a decent job in France. There's been an upswing in extremism in France because the government has had a long history of excluding and marginalizing certain groups, and extremist organizations have done a pretty good job of recruiting people to do attacks and so forth in France. I certainly think that it's worked amongst the Palestinians in the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, and there are lots of other places where that kind of thinking has worked fairly successfully.
Why has the United States done relatively, I mean, there was 9/11, but relatively okay compared to some of these other countries?
So, and I want to put a big caveat before what I'm about to say, but in general, the U.S. has been much more open to immigrants and to people who are different than a lot of Western European and Eastern European countries.
Even with Trump and his wall?
So this is a fairly new development, and like I said, there's a caveat here. But there's been a history here where immigrants come, and at some point in the process, in the second generation, they're seen as Americans. And it doesn't matter if they're Jewish or they're Muslim, and is there discrimination against certain groups? Yes. But if you compare that to levels of societal discrimination against a lot of groups in Europe, we're doing a better job.
Let's go to Michael in Poughkeepsie, Poe-town. Michael in Poe-town, you're on.
Yes. But one thing I was always wondering, how come no politicians or moderate imams have stated that since the terrorist groups relish in the killing of innocents, which is actually goes against the laws of jihad, in my understanding, because in the laws, unless I'm mistaken, the laws of jihad said that they should attack only warriors. So how come none of them have ever stated that these terrorists or whatever, what groups they are, that they have abandoned the Muslim faith to become Satan's crusaders? Because I do know that the word crusader can really rile up Muslims around the world. And if you call them Satan's crusader, you could really drive the point home.
So I agree with you that calling them and demonizing them is a huge problem. Where I'm going to disagree with you, Michael, is there are plenty of imams who've said, this is not Islam, this is not what you should be doing, this is wrong, these people are not preaching the true message of Muhammad.
I have to say, Michael, that both that professor and this professor have cautioned our students for years, don't say no one. Because you're always going to be wrong.
But I would go further, Alan, and I would say there have been plenty, in the United States certainly, plenty of
imams.
Muslims leaders who've said, hey guys, this is not what Islam represents. This is not what Islam should be.
Yeah. Thank you, Michael.
I know. Yeah. Well, I agree that they said that nothing about, that they do not represent the tenets of Islam. But how, my question is, how come they have never said that they have completely abandoned the Muslim faith?
Well, why should they? Why should they? Look, there's Jewish guys, I'm Jewish, who have, you know, who have done despicable things. Does that mean all Jews are despicable?
Oh, no. I'm saying that they say that the people who carry out these terrorist attacks, they have abandoned the Muslim faith.
I see what you mean.
Okay, so, okay. Michael, I would actually encourage you to go to Google and put in quotes, the phrase, ISIS is not, are not Muslims. And I'll bet you $5 that if you put that into Google, you will find some Muslims and some Muslim leaders who've actually said that.
Michael, got to let you go. Thank you. Okay, we'll go to John in Albany. But before we do, I want to remind everybody the telephone number is 1-800-348-2551. All right, John, you're on.
Hi, John. There.
Hi, John.
I'm curious with these individual actors who commit terrorist acts but aren't kind of directly being directed by a larger organization. What's the balance of kind of treating them as, treating it as a criminal issue, a political issue, a mental health issue? It seems like it's all of these things.
So I would say I agree with it. It's all of these things. I think that once you politicize killing, I would move it from crime. Not that it isn't a crime, but I really see it as a political issue. And I think that lone wolves are still terrorists, even if they're not directly connected to organizations. And the kind of terrorism that you're talking about is lone wolf. There have been studies related to there used to be people who argued that terrorism was a result of mental health issues. And they've actually done studies on this, and it's not true. Are there terrorists who have mental health issues? Yes. But there are plenty of people who've been interviewed by psychologists who are terrorists, and they don't have mental health issues. What they primarily are is really, really, really angry, which is not the same thing as having a mental health issue. Again, not to say that there haven't been terrorists with mental health issues, but there are lots and lots of them. So terrorism really can't be tied to that particular aspect.
You know, Victor Saul, I'm not sure I agree with that. Only because I think when somebody is terribly, terribly, terribly angry, over the top, out of the norm, it may be a mental health issue.
So I'm going to not agree with your not agreement. and the reason I'm going to not agree with your not agreement, so there were people who went and interviewed Palestinian terrorists in Israeli jails. Mm-hmm. And what they found is that these were people who were very, very angry about substantive issues that they felt this had to be challenged. And they felt the right way to challenge it was through violence. So they're angry about it, but I didn't see them but they weren't characterized as being mentally challenged or mental health issues.
Michael, thank you. We're going to take a short break. We'll be right back.
Support for WAMC comes from the Preservation League of New York State, presenting John Freeman Gill, author of The Gargoyle Hunters, Friday, June 2nd, University Club of Albany, So Our Past Has a Future, preserveNYS.org. Elements Hot Tub Spa, downtown Amherst, Massachusetts, offering hot tubs in 5 indoor or outdoor private rooms, plus a team of massage therapists for individuals and couples. ElementsHotTubSpa.com for gift certificates and photo gallery. Mango Tree Imports, a Saratoga Springs fair trade shop with gift items from 60 countries. MangoTreeImports.com. And College Street Motors, Amherst, Massachusetts. For over 30 years, specializing in foreign and domestic car and truck repair and 24-hour towing, full-service gas includes checking of fluids, tire pressure, and window washing. CollegeStreetMotors.com.
And we are back with Professor Victor Assal of the Rockefeller College of Public Affairs and Policy, where he heads the Project on Violence Conflict. Okay, so Victor, if I may call you that, I guess the next question I have is what do you think is likely to happen now in terms of Donald Trump's views on how all this should be handled?
I don't think it's going to change at all. I think these kind of attacks validate President Trump's view of the world. President Trump sees certain groups of people as being the bad guys. And that was his platform when he ran for president. People were surprised by how non-confrontational he was in Saudi Arabia. And I think these kind of attacks are the kind of ammunition he needs to very likely go back to the same kind of language he was using before, depending on the feedback he gets from his advisors.
Well, Michael and Ben are waiting to talk to us on the air, but before we go there, I've been fascinated. You see a golden opportunity in Iran right now. Mm-hmm. You see a moderate elected, wants closer relations with America, wants the young people there are really having a profound influence. Trump wants none of it.
I agree. I have no... There's a theory in international relations called rational actor theory, which says there are costs and benefits. You weigh the costs and benefits, and you go with what's going to give you the lowest costs and the highest benefits. And President Trump doesn't seem to be playing by that model at the moment.
Okay. We'll go to Michael in Rhinebeck. All right, Michael in Rhinebeck, your turn. Go ahead.
I wanted to ask your guest, thank you for taking my call. Sure. I wanted to ask you and your guest to talk about this idea of ISIS behaving as sort of a death cult and that they're not operating in what we would consider a normal or even radical religious way, but they have gone one step further than that, both in the way they recruit people, keep people, and then use them for this quasi-political agenda that they have. And I wanted to hear you guys respond to that.
Perfect song.
So I would say I would argue that ISIS is not a death cult yet. ISIS is a terrorist organization. And ISIS is following the model of many organizations in the past and organizations that continue to exist now, of using people to sow disharmony and to sow terror. And they're selecting people who they believe they can get to blow themselves up or to go on missions where they're going to die in order to kill who they see as the enemy. And this is no different than what Hamas has done, or Hezbollah, or Fatah, or lots of other organizations in the past. For me, when I think of a death cult, I think more of the majority. Yes, the majority of the organization saying we're all going to die. And I really don't think ISIS has any intention of the organization dying anytime soon.
Which is interesting, because it isn't the guys who are running ISIS who are blowing themselves up.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Michael, anything else?
I understand part of that argument. I think that the nihilist part of it, I mean, you say death cult and you think Jim Jones after the fact, after they all drank the Kool-Aid and shot the senator and everybody on the runway. But the path toward that and how they're attracting people
so Michael,
to this... Yeah.
So, Michael, what I would say is the way I would differentiate is I think what, and this is, I think, gets at a little bit of what you're talking about, which is I think ISIS is exploiting people who want to be martyrs. Okay? The organization itself doesn't want to martyr the organization, and they don't want the organization to focus on death in terms of the members of the organization. But it wants to exploit members and people who are inspired by the organization to embrace martyrdom, because that martyrdom actually helps the organization grow. Does that make sense?
Yeah, they're growing by killing themselves and killing other people.
Not
and they're
killing
celebrating
themselves.
In that death.
By having certain members kill themselves.
No, members of the group. And large. I mean, and the soldiers that are participating in the war, the kind of war they're fighting, and the way that death and dismemberment of the enemy is celebrated in this very nihilist way, it has a different character. And I haven't spent the time you have studying it, but it has a very different character to my eye than even what Al Qaeda was doing.
Okay, Michael, just for the sake of argument, I want to ask you the question, and the question is: what would you do right now if you were this country or the leadership of this country?
I think we're in a really difficult situation because
that's true.
I don't think what the president is doing is helpful at all. But I also don't think, and I responded to the conversation that we were having earlier, you guys were having this morning, I don't think trying to find some kind of socioeconomic explanation for why people are making these choices is helpful for us either. I think that it's a really desperate
situation. So what would you do?
I think, I think what the Obama administration was doing, which was fighting a really hard covert war and trying to, at the same time, use the State Department and reach out and create coalitions with the people that were there and trying to clean up what was going on for the last 15 years is kind of the only way forward. But it's an awful path. It's not easy.
No, none of this is easy. I would argue that I think the socioeconomic explanations actually matter, because it helps us get at the root of not why particular individuals are embracing this, but why groups of people are embracing this. And if you can address some of
but
those...
Isn't that more...
Well, one second,
isn't
Michael.
Isn't that more global political? Yes, sorry.
So let me just finish here. So if you can address, for example, in a country, what are the socioeconomic factors that are pushing people in that direction? If you can make those socioeconomic factors better, then it doesn't necessarily mean that you can eliminate this kind of behavior, but you can reduce this kind of behavior in a very serious way.
So in the case of Israel, Victor... Mm-hmm. Where Trump is still, is he still in Israel? I don't know.
I believe he still is in
Israel. And the Palestinians are filled with this kind of frustration.
Yes, they are.
Would you make it easier for the Palestinians?
I think that in the long run, the Israelis are going to have to face an existential question.
We've been hearing this for years, you know.
I know. I'm aware of that, and the existential question continues to be there and become much more problematic. Mm-hmm. And at some point, the Israelis are going to have to choose, and we're going in a little bit of a different direction.
Well, no, but I think it is not necessarily a different direction. No.
Yeah. The Israelis are going to have to choose whether they want to be one of the following: a smaller state with a potentially contentious and dangerous neighbor, a state that maintains itself as the size that it is now, but it becomes an apartheid state, or a state which stops being a Jewish state. And it's going to have to choose one of those three choices. And at some point, it's going to have to choose one of the three. And that's an existential question if I ever heard one.
Indeed. Hey, Michael, I thank you for participating in this. We're going to go to Ben, who has been hanging on for 8 minutes and 12 seconds. Ben, you're on the air. Go ahead, Ben.
Alan, thanks for taking my call.
No, nothing to it. I apologize for keeping you waiting. Go ahead.
You asked the last caller, what would you do now? So I'll pick up on that.
Sure.
There is nothing to do now. Because are you saying about because of the bombing over there?
Yeah. Or no. No, the bombing over there as a piece in the puzzle. In other words, there is this.
Our society and our obsession with terrorism is out of control. Let's talk a little bit about that. The percentage of our society and people making their money on security and weapons and guns, it's unbelievable. Mm-hmm. It's so far outsized from the actual threat of any sort of terrorism here on our soil. Now, would you agree with that?
No. What if you were one of the 20 peak families that have just suffered these grievous losses?
That's an emotional appeal.
That's an emotional deal? Well, it may be an emotional deal, but let me tell you about politicians. Victor and I were having this very discussion before.
We're talking about terrorism.
No, but we're also talking about response to terrorism, right?
And look at the kinds of politicians that are becoming empowered by using this non-existent threat.
Agreed. But okay, that's the way it is. Yeah, go ahead.
That is the way it is. So you want to know what should we do?
What I want to know.
More security? I mean, I was on the subway, you go on the subway, and there's a bunch of guys there with assault weapons. That you think they work for free? How much money are we spending on all this stuff?
So, Ben, I think there are a couple issues here. First of all, whenever I give a talk on terrorism, I start my talk by explaining that you're much more likely in the United States to die from a car accident than you are from a terrorist attack.
Exactly.
By the way, that's not true of some other countries. Some other countries, it is really an existential threat. To the United States, there are a couple of real challenging issues when it comes to terrorism. One challenging issue when it comes to terrorism is humans are not rational, and humans respond much more to what we would call threat perception than actual threat. And humans see the kind of threat that terrorism is with a much graver view than they do of other kinds of threats. This is why people are much more scared of getting on planes, even though planes are much safer than cars, they're still more scared of getting on planes.
That is all true.
Politicians respond to threat perception, and politicians exploit threat perception. And so on the one hand, some politicians benefit from threat perception because they can exploit it for their own benefit in getting elected. But on the other hand, a lot of politicians feel pressured to respond to threat perception because that's what their voters are concerned about. So they've got to try and deal with those issues. It's not an easy solution. Now, here's the challenge that comes not from a threat perception perspective, but from a protection perspective. So on the one hand, yes, cars kill a lot more people than terrorism does. On the other hand, there are what we might think of as game-changing terrorist acts. And 9/11 was a game-changing terrorist act, okay? And people who protect America need to be cognizant and try and figure out how to protect us from those kinds of acts of terrorism. And the real challenge there is that they're so uncommon. So I'll give you an explicit example. There's a type of terrorism called CBRN terrorism. That's chemical, biological, radiological, nuclear terrorism. There's been very little of this kind of terrorism in the United States or, frankly, in the entire world. But biological terrorism and nuclear terrorism are the kind of thing where the likelihood that it's going to happen is very, very small, but the repercussions of it happening are enormous and terrifying. And so there are two factors here that are pushing us in a direction that I agree with you can be very problematic and unhealthy, but politicians need to recognize how to deal with it. One is this threat perception, which is not based necessarily on the likelihood of regular terrorism killing thousands of Americans. But voters want politicians to pay attention to this and to deal with it. So that's why we get all sorts of investments in security that we may or may not need. And then there's this other threat of a real serious existential threat.
Well, stay on that point about the investment that you're calling an investment. How much money are we spending on all this stuff? And how are those armed men standing on a subway platform having any effect against the type of terrorism which really does exist, which is not going to happen on a subway platform where they're standing?
Well, let me just
we have militarized and our society to a great extent because of 9/11 and terrorism and all that stuff.
Well, let me just add my 2 cents here for whatever it's worth, which ain't much. 2 cents worth. And that is, as Victor has pointed out in this discussion, very little of this kind of terrorism has happened in the United States. Now, your hypothesis, Victor, is, I think if I understood it correctly, is that the reason we haven't had that much is that we treat immigrants better in the United States than they do in France. Is that right?
No, it's because of CIA and those type of agencies monitor that stuff and they stop it from happening.
No. I'm going to disagree with you. I'm going to say that the CIA and those agencies have stopped some terrorism, and they've done an efficient job.
As has the guy in the it may well be as the guy with the gun in the subway.
That is correct. But one of the huge factors I believe that has played a role in why the U.S. has had so much less terrorism in this country than in Western Europe is that the U.S., while there has been a growth in anti-Muslim treatment since 9/11, the U.S. has done tremendously better at including and making part and making Muslims and other groups feel American in a way that Europe, many countries in Europe, have failed dismally at.
And how do we know you're right about that? Is there any proof?
So there are polls that people have done.
Because we're not seeing bombings like that here, Alan. That's the answer.
Well, I agree with that assessment. But also, if you go and you do, I have colleagues who've looked at the treatment of Muslims in France. And Muslims in France have been excluded in a horrific way. They've been put in the banlieues, the areas, these ghettos outside of France proper. They've been excluded from all sorts of different issues. Now, do we have those kinds of issues in the United States? Yes, but nowhere to the degree that Muslims have faced in Europe. They haven't been demonized here in that same way at least until recently by the government.
Mm-hmm.
The government's tried very hard not to demonize, and that isn't necessarily the case in some of these other countries.
You don't think Donald Trump has tried to demonize?
Well, like I said, until recently.
Okay. All right. Thank you very much, Mike. Ben, I appreciate your call.
Let me
go ahead.
Let's remember, now, I'm not the biggest fan of George W. Bush for a whole host of reasons, but President Bush made a sincere and significant effort to remind the American people that this wasn't about Islam and that Muslims are not inherently bad people or necessarily bad people, and that mattered a lot.
Okay. We'll go to Tom in Amherst. All right. 1-800-348-2551. Okay, Tom in Amherst, you're on.
Hey, thanks, guys, for taking my call. I have
sure.
a question about, and part of it maybe has been answered, but the historical drivers behind the Middle East terror, and what is the U.S.'s role in this? I mean, are we partially to blame? I just One example I'll give is, you know, during the Reagan administration, we supported the rebels in the war in Afghanistan. And one of the last comments, if you read the book, Charlie Wilson's War, is, you know, now the crazies are going to come flooding in. You know, if we hadn't done that, maybe we wouldn't have destabilized it. If we wouldn't have gone into Iraq, maybe young children who are looking at their families blown up, you know, wouldn't be thinking about getting involved in terror. So, you know, I'm curious about your perspective on that.
Okay, so basically, the U.S. has spent a lot of time supporting very repressive governments around the world for a long time.
Right.
And it's made a lot of people angry. And
yep.
Now, if you're going to support repressive governments, then if they're stable, you can get something out of it. But if you report repressive governments and then you break them, or you go into a country and you break the country, and then you support people who are killing other people, you're saying to people, come kill Americans. And we kind of did that in Iraq.
We did.
Okay? Afghanistan was already a mess, and we messed up in Afghanistan by helping them overthrow, but then basically saying, screw you, we're not doing any more of this, and you're left alone. And that really made life difficult for them. But Iraq is totally on us. And we created all sorts of bad situations there, which then went over to Syria and created all sorts of problems there. Okay? So the U.S. has had a history of supporting repressive governments, and people in those areas, in the final analysis, did not turn to democracy, did not turn to nonviolent mobilization. They turned to violence, and they turned to radical ideologies and demonizing the United States. And in some cases, they're angry at the United States is completely justified.
We're going to take a break. I'm sorry, Tom, but that's all the time we have for you
all
today.
All right. Thank you, guys.
Thanks
appreciate
an awful
it.
Lot. Bye. We'll take a short break, and we will be right back.
Support for WAMC comes from the Waldorf School of Saratoga Springs, giving children the education and tools for the challenges of an ever-changing world. WaldorfSaratoga.org. Vision Excel Eye Care, Lake Katrine. Exams, eye care, dry eye therapy, and now new American-made frames where eyewear is an art. VisionExcelEyeCare.com. Interim Healthcare, celebrating 46 years of in-home care, supporting the Mohawk Hudson Land Conservancy and their free wilderness survival skills workshop on June 11th at Holt Preserve. InterimHealthcare.com for information. Harold's Ice Cream, Thorne's Marketplace, Old South Street, downtown Northampton, Massachusetts. Dairy and No Moo Dairy Free, handmade artisan ice cream, sweet baked goods, hot fudge, and more. Harold's.com. And the Department of Theater Arts at SUNY New Paltz, an undergraduate theater program in liberal arts with concentrations in design and technology, theater studies, and performance. newpaltz.edu/theatre.
And we are back. Thank you, Zachary. The number to call is 1-800-348-2551. 1-800-348-2551. We have Professor Victor Assal of the University of Albany's Rockefeller College of Public Affairs and Policy, where he heads the Project on Violence Conflict. As if that wasn't enough, he also is chair of the Public Administration Department, something I wouldn't wish on anybody, but he is. So there we go. Now we're going to talk to Ben in the Berkshires. Ben, you haven't been on today, have you?
No, I haven't been on yet today. This is a different Ben.
Okay, yeah, we got an awful lot of Ben and Michaels today. Go ahead, Ben.
As I'm hearing you guys talk about, you know, kind of contrasting, you know, the issues of terrorism within Europe versus the issues of terrorism within the United States, I guess I just don't hear you guys mentioning what I would think would be the obvious, would be that, you know, with migrating, large migrating groups, you know, essentially refugees migrating out of, you know, areas that are predominantly Muslim areas, I guess I just would think that the issue of the vicinity factor, I mean, there's you know, relative to, you know, large migratory groups getting to the United States versus, you know, large migratory groups getting to Europe, it would just seem that, you know, the issues of these groups, you know, arriving, establishing, essentially integrating into the, Western European cultures, would just be, it just seemed like it would be a little bit, it just seems like a very difficult thing to even try to contrast when you're looking at it on the surface, a large group of people moving into an area, a completely different culture. There's obviously going to be more clashing going on there, and then what's going to happen with the carefully screened immigrants coming into the United States.
Okay. Wait a minute. Whoa. Before you go on, of course, we have 12 million reasons you're wrong. There are 12 million people here who did migrate and who have a different value structure than many of the people who are so angry who move into these other places. Am I wrong about that, Victor?
So I would say you're about 90% right, yeah. But Ben is at least 10% right.
I'd rather have my 90 than his 10.
I agree, but it's important to recognize both. So I think Ben, the point that Alan's making is we have lots and lots of immigrants here. We have lots and lots of refugees, and I think it's important to note that most of the terrorist attacks that are happening, Islamist terrorist attacks that are happening being perpetrated by second generation or third generation people, or by people who are coming in not as immigrants. So the 9/11 attackers were not coming in,
or the Boston Marathon,
or the Boston Marathon. They were not coming. He was second generation.
Yeah.
One of them was second generation. One of them was first generation. So, but I will say, and where I do think that there's something to be said, Ben, is that in the last 5 or 6 years. There's already been a history of mistreatment of Muslims in France and other countries in the UK, and exclusion and ostracization in these countries. But that has been exacerbated by this huge flow of refugees, really, from the mess that is Iraq and Syria and other countries. And because these countries have not been ready for these people, and because they already have a situation where these people are seen as the others, it's making the situation worse. So I grant
yet,
you
Victor,
that.
And yet, Victor, they're there.
Yep.
As opposed to here. So I think it's a point you just made. Yeah. Go ahead.
And I wouldn't want for a second for you guys to think I'm calling into this, hardliner, right winger, all immigrants are bad. That's not how I feel. But I can certainly understand the challenges within the European communities where all of a sudden there's a giant. And I'm actually on the opposite end of that spectrum. I sympathize with refugees. So But I can also sympathize with the folks that are in those communities. These are millennia old communities that have been functioning in essentially certain set of standards and cultural norms, and then all of a sudden there's just a big influx, and I just feel like there's no good answer to how to get these two together.
So Ben, I think there may not be any great answer, but there are some good answers. These governments should be putting more resources and more efforts into trying to integrate these groups into their society and being accepting into their society. Let me give you an example, okay? Have you heard of any real horrible terrorism happening in Germany?
No.
Yes, you haven't. And Germany is a country that has been accepting a whole bunch of refugees and has been dealing with these issues also. They have a history of having a large Turkish population brought into the country in the 1960s and 70s. Germany has made a tremendous effort to educate these people, to acculturate these people, and to include these people. And that doesn't mean there's never going to be terrorism in Germany or there hasn't been terrorism in Germany, because there has. But Germany has made a much more serious effort at being an open place and an accepting place. And the results are that Germany has seen a lot less of this problem than other countries in Europe.
Does it have anything to do with their past?
Everything to do with their past.
Yeah, right.
It has everything to do with their past.
I thought it was very interesting that you said, ironically, we did better in that department under George Bush. Isn't that something? You keep on having those strange kind of seeming thoughts pass through my own mind about George Bush seems like a progressive compared to the goings on in this current.
Let me give you a concrete example. So my last name is Arabic, okay? My father's from Tunisia. And I, you know, before 9/11, I rarely had anybody say anything to me or call me out at all on any issue. And after 9/11, there was a spike in you know, being stereotyped because of my last name.
But you're not an Arab.
Well, I'm a Middle Easterner. My father's from Tunisia.
Are you Jewish?
Yes, but you know, that the issue here is, well, you can't look at me and tell me I'm Jewish, but you can see my last name and see that I'm a Middle Easterner. And before 9/11, nobody was, you know, very rarely was somebody seeing that and typifying me. And after 9/11, there was a spike of being typified when I got to the airport.
I get it.
Right?
Sure.
So we're doing better than Europe is in that direction.
Huh. Okay. Ben, thank you very much for your call. Appreciate it. All right. The telephone number is, and you'll get in. The next guy who calls, next woman who calls, is going to get in. 1-800-348-2551. 1-800-348-2551. So I suppose that you and I were having a little brief conversation before, and I loved it because you're a better person than I am. I have always thought with politicians, the whole idea is get reelected, forget about everything else. I've known an awful lot of politicians, worked with them for years. When John Kennedy, or whoever wrote it for him, wrote Profiles in Courage, it isn't every politician who can give up their political aspirations in order to do the right thing. What do you make of that?
So I think that there are lots and lots of politicians who are there to get elected and to get power. I think we are protected, and it's very important to have those politicians who are willing to lose elections in order to do the right thing. I think that's key. And we've had those in the past.
Okay, name one again.
Lincoln.
Yeah, no, okay, that's quite a way back.
There have been other politicians that have been willing to lose elections.
Yeah.
I'll give you an example from Israel. Yitzhak Rabin.
Yes.
Rabin knew that by the platform he was taking in terms of trying to make peace with the Palestinians was very likely to lose the election. Same thing with...
the guy on the other side, right?
Right. And so there are politicians out there willing to do it. The question is if we have enough of them at the moment.
Well, I'd like to see any of them, let alone enough of them.
You want to start with one or two?
So we've got a Jeff in Montague, New Jersey. Okay, Jeff, you called first, and as promised, you're on. Go ahead.
Yes, thank you. I hope you can hear me. There was some problem hearing me.
No, we can hear you.
I'm half Arabic, by the way. My grandparents came from Syria at the turn of the 19th century. Osama bin Laden chose to attack the World Trade Center because he wanted a religious war. He wanted to attack the United States. He was tired of Arabs slaughtering each other for the past 1,000 years. Second point, it was the kindness of Jimmy Carter that led to the fall of the Shah and the slaughter of the Iranian Shiites for the past 40 years. You cannot blame this on the United States.
I can't blame what on the United States?
You cannot blame the attitude of the Islamic world on the United States being a power, an insensitive power.
So, Jeff, I'm not blaming everything on the United States. What I'm saying is that there have been U.S. policies in the past that have exacerbated issues that have made things worse. Much of this is the responsibility of the authoritarian and dictatorial regimes in the Middle East being horrendous to their people. But unfortunately, the United States has been very supportive of many of those regimes that have been oppressive of their people. So it's not just
very, very true. But in supporting, in pulling out and not supporting those impressive regimes, they have just been replaced by oppressive regimes. Okay, pulling out of Iraq has allowed the president of Iraq, Assad, to slaughter his own people. Not backing up the Shah has caused the Ayatollah Khomeini to not only slaughter his own people, but to be in one of the biggest wars with Iraq at its time.
And how would you have backed up the Shah? Whoa, Jeff, how would you have backed up the Shah? Remind me of that.
I would have let the Shah stay where he is.
I don't think that wasn't your choice.
It wasn't going to happen. The U.S. was backing the Shah. The people of Iran had basically risen up. The majority of them had risen up against the Shah and kicked him out. And then in the same way that in the Russian Revolution there were several different parties and one party took control, same thing in the Iranian Revolution. In terms of Syria, we had no good solution at Syria. The larger issue was Iraq.
Yes, except Jeff's point is well taken. I think the point is well taken that we can't decide who to back. I mean, we backed Osama bin Laden. That's true. And now the Obama administration was saying there are good moderates and bad moderates. Well, I wasn't ever so sure of that. Victor?
You can do a better job or a worse job. One of the mistakes I think that the Obama administration made was there was an opportunity at the beginning of the Syrian breakdown to back organizations that actually were supportive of democracy, were actually inclusive, and they just took three steps back and the extremists took over.
Jeff, I'm kicking you off. Wait, I'm kicking you off only for one reason. Your phone line stinks, and you're going to drive our Zach Malloy into a real state of bad news. So
I want to thank you though. Thank you for allowing me to speak.
Okay, thanks a lot. Bye-bye. Okay, and we'll go to Sean in Beni, which I assume means Albany. Go ahead, Sean. You're on.
Hey, Alan. Hey, Victor. Thank you so much for taking my call. And, thank you so much for sharing everything that you do on your programs. I really do learn a lot, and I feel like you guys are really educating a lot of people about these really big issues, and I really appreciate that. I think it's really important.
Thanks.
Anyways, my question. Where is the diplomacy right now? Do we have, contacts, within these organizations that we're fighting against, that are bent on our destruction, so to speak? Didn't we used to talk to our enemies to find out who they are, what they're doing? I mean, these are people. These are humans like us, just in different conditions.
Okay, we're going to let Victor answer. We're going to let Victor answer this because we are coming close to the end of the program. Victor.
There are several different kinds.
Thank you so much.
Thanks, Sean.
Stay there.
It's a good question, Sean. There are different kinds of adversaries in life. Okay, they're the adversaries you can talk to and possibly come to an agreement with. They're the adversaries. It's like high school. They're the adversaries you are going to stay adversaries with, but you can come to you live your life, I live my life.
And then
the adversaries who want to kill you, and all they want to do is kill you, and all they want to do is kill you, and there's nothing to talk about.
I'm 75 years old, and I remember those guys.
Well, they're still around. So, for example, Fatah or the PLO was an adversary of the United States and of Israel that was willing to talk and had something that could come to an agreement with. I don't think ISIS or Al-Qaeda has any space in their perspectives for coming to an agreement with the United States. It's just not there.
Yeah, but what about the question is, are we doing what we can diplomatically? A lot of people have raised on our morning program and other that we have named ambassadors. The State Department is bereft of people.
I completely agree with that, but that's a different issue. Okay.
Why is it so different?
The issue is
you can't do it if you don't have them.
I understood from Sean is why are we not reaching out diplomatically to ISIS or Al Qaeda?
Okay.
And on that level, I don't think there is anything to reach out to.
So they're the third kind of bully.
Yes. Okay. On the other hand, the fact that our State Department
is.
Right, but there are some people that until they're ready, and sometimes people can change, but until they're ready, there's nothing to talk about. Now, what I'm going to agree with both of you on is that the U.S. government so far has really depleted and not restocked the State Department and our ambassadors, and that is hurting us because we need those people out there doing what they need to do for the people. Sean, to attract people who might be supporters, and that's a different aspect.
Sean, I apologize, but we are run up against the end of the program. Thank you so much for calling, Sean. Thanks.
Thank you so much. Thank you. I really appreciate it.
Yeah. We are just about out of time. I want to thank our very wonderful guest, Victor Assal of University of Albany's Rockefeller College of Public Affairs and Policy, for joining us on the program today. Support for the Vox Pop comes from the Black Sheep, downtown Amherst, a new-style delicatessen and European-style all-butter-scratch bakery, caterer, and cafe offering fair trade coffee, blacksheepdeli.com. Jane Iredale, a mineral makeup company specializing in makeup that is good for the skin. Jane Iredale, retail shop at Louisa Ellis Boutique, Great Barrington, janeiredale.com. The Albany Pine Bush Preserve, presenting opportunities to the Capital Region to engage in conservation science. Lecture series and citizen science participants helping collect data and research, albanypinebush.org, and Capital Roots, providing the space, know-how, and resources for Capital Region residents to grow their own food in 52 community gardens, capitalroots.org, for information on how to support. Thanks again for joining us on the Vox Pop. Our engineer has been Zach Malloy, still has his hair. Your calls were answered by Susie Chekai. Producer Jim Lavoulis. I'm Alan Shartok. Stay tuned now for a news update.